You're listening to 91.5 KUNV, and this is Neon Eden. I'm your host, Tovin LePan, reporter for the Las Vegas Sun. My co-host, Patrick Kuhlkin, will return next week. Immigration has dominated the news cycle recently with a decision by President Barack Obama to spare some young immigrants from possible deportation and the Supreme Court ruling on Monday that struck down 3 out of 4 provisions of Arizona's controversial immigration enforcement law. This morning, my guest is Peter Ashman, an immigration attorney in Las Vegas for 27 years and a spokesman for the Las Vegas chapter of the American Immigration Lawyers Association. Thanks for joining us.
You're welcome. Pleasure to be here.
And now, Peter, you've been in immigration law for a long time, and I was hoping you could just put this current period in history in context. Is this current level of discourse, the debate that's going on around immigration, is this unique in history, or is this something that we go through every 20 years or every time, you know, a president might address the issue and then we get a back and forth that goes on like this?
Well, I think immigration has always brought out maybe the worst in political discourse. It's a very emotionally charged issue for some reason. Even going back as far as like the Reagan amnesty back in the 80s, there was still a lot of rancor and, you know, hard feelings and, you know, back and forth. That really kind of started, set the stage for where we are today, because the Reagan amnesty did two things. It gave mass amnesty, but at the same time, it created a system of employer sanctions where employers were supposed to be punished for hiring undocumented workers. Well, that never really was enforced the way it probably should have. And I think, you know, people on both sides of the argument can disagree to that to some extent. But it became very easy for people to kind of look the other way when someone showed false documents to them. And sometimes there was like a wink and, you know, a sideways glance. And next thing you know, employers are hiring hundreds of people. Occasionally, over the time, you would hear about massive immigration arrests at meatpacking plants in Iowa or chicken farms in Arkansas. But at the end of the day, I mean, the ability to enforce these laws has not really been there. And you could say probably because it was never a priority for the federal government to enforce those employer sanction laws. So then over time, since the 80s, you had a situation where millions and millions of workers came into the country because there were jobs here. And the fact that there were jobs here is not necessarily a bad thing. It just indicates our economy was strong. And so the need for these jobs could not be filled with the domestic economy. And so the numbers of undocumented workers swelled and swelled and swelled till at one point recently it reached approximately 15 million.
And it probably bears noting, right, that it didn't seem that the country as a whole was very conscious of this idea of an illegal immigrant population in the United States that was necessarily a public policy issue that needed to be addressed, you know, quickly until, I mean, what was it, 2007, when, you know, then when we had our immigration marches and reaction to proposals. And what changed then? You know, why at that moment? You know, it seemed up to that point.
Well, I think, you know, there had been an increase in enforcement after 9/11. Documentation requirements got more strict. You know, you had biometrics on. I think we've all noticed that how our driver's licenses have changed, mm-hmm. and that reflects the Real ID Act. So they had to have biometrically secure fingerprints and photographs and holograms on there so they couldn't be forged. And that drove a lot of people into a situation where they couldn't provide the documentation to work. I think that was one of the issues. And just an overall, like states like Arizona beginning to create laws that tried to enforce the federal immigration laws.
Mm-hmm. And so getting to the Arizona laws, on Monday we had the decision and the Supreme Court struck down 3 out of the 4 provisions. And, you know, a lot of observers, when the arguments were going on, They thought from the line of questioning from the justices that there was a lot of predictions that they would uphold the entire law or the majority
right.
of it. But you were telling me it's a dangerous game to try and predict what Supreme Court judges are going to decide.
Well, it is. I mean, I can tell you cases that I really believed I was going to win, and then I came out with a loss, and vice versa. You never really know. I think it's funny watching the news media last night and watching everybody claiming victory on this Supreme Court decision. People on both sides were claiming victory. I thought that was kind of funny.
Mm. And so in getting that, so the three provisions upheld. The ones that were struck down, were that it made it a crime for immigrants to fail to register with the federal government and carry proof of legal residency. That was struck down, as well as the provision that made it a crime for illegal immigrants to work or to try to find work. And then the final provision stated that it authorized police to arrest immigrants without a warrant when probable cause existed that they had committed a public offense that would lead to deportation under federal law. And so those three, and based the federal government's case in that, for those three, and basically the whole law, their whole challenge to the law was that that Arizona had overstepped their boundaries basically as a state and were entering into what's exclusively federal territory.
Right. Right. I think it's important to recognize that, you know, the 50 states are have a area of sovereignty. I mean, Nevada, for example, it's legal to have slot machines and prostitution in some of our counties. And across the border in Utah, it's not. And that's because each state has some level of sovereignty within its borders. However, part of the alliance, if you will, of the 50 states says that, you know, certain powers or certain abilities are going to be reserved to the federal government, are going to stay with federal government, like, you know, the ability to regulate currency. I mean, I remember a few years ago in Nevada, there was a congressional candidate or a gubernatorial candidate wanted to put Nevada on the silver standard. Well, that's patently impermissible under our Constitution. So one of the things that the states, what Arizona tried to do was to criminalize basically being an illegal immigrant. That's sort of redundant. Let's use better terms, but to try to criminalize someone who is here without papers and make that a crime. Because if they could make that a crime, then they could hold them and detain them and you know, arrest them. But what the Supreme Court said was, Arizona, you can't do that. Because, first of all, it's a federal power, and we have federal judges, immigration judges, that are there to determine people's status, which is not always an easy determination. And if the states are left to make that determination, they may not get it right. And they may, like Arizona, may come up with one system of laws, and then New Mexico could come up with something else, and Texas. And before you know it, you have 50 different immigration laws in the country. Who's going to administer all that? So when the federal government came in and struck down the three parts, I'm sorry, when the Supreme Court came down and ruled that those three portions you mentioned were unconstitutional, what they're really saying is the state of Arizona does not have the ability to criminalize status. And so the part that remained, which is the part about federal or state law enforcement agents in Arizona requiring that when they've stopped somebody for a crime or some legitimate purpose, that they are required to obtain their immigration status if they feel that there could be reason why that person could be illegal, which whatever that means.
Right. And so, yeah, let's get to this idea was reasonable suspicion is the term in terms of what was upheld as far as the Arizona law enforcement authorities, when they stop someone, and, right. Say for a traffic stop or any other stop, that if they have reasonable suspicion, they should check their immigration status. And,
right.
And I mean, that's a pretty vague term. I mean, is there any precedent? How do you balance reasonable suspicion with what opponents would say will inevitably lead to racial profiling?
Well, it was interesting. I watched Governor Brewer last night on one of the news programs, and when she was asked that question, she just deferred and said, well, you know, law enforcement agents are trained to know that. Well, I'm still not convinced that that's a good answer, because how do you look at somebody and try to guess whether or not that person has legal status in this country or not? Is it their accent? I can tell you, I have U.S. citizen clients that have an accent. Is it their skin color? Do they drive around in a car with a peel-in bumper sticker on it? I mean, what logistically could a police officer be expected to know to try to decide whether that person is, if they have a reasonable suspicion of being an illegal immigrant?
Now, I talked to a local representative from American Citizens United. That's a group in Arizona and here in Nevada that has advocated for, stricter border enforcement, deportation of the unauthorized immigrant population in the country. And one thing, one of their representatives mentioned that she thought it would be perfectly legitimate to base, say, reasonable suspicion on just the fact if the person's not functional in English. If you pull someone over and they're driving, they're not fluent in English. Or she also suggested that if they fail to produce insurance or a registration for the car, that would be suspicion that they're in the country illegally. Would that, in your opinion, would that pass legal muster?
No, I don't think so. I don't mean to be too critical of groups like that. I mean, they're trying to do what they think is in the best interest of America. And clearly, all sides can agree on the fact that the federal government has failed to deal with the immigration problem. So their solution, groups like this, their solution is to, you know, lean heavily on enforcement. But they ignore the underlying reason why there's a problem in the first place, which is, you know, our strong economy, or it was, coupled with a really functional inability to gain control over the border, who comes in and who comes out.
In your opinion, you know, we talk about border enforcement and securing the border, which, you know, most people, when they say the border, they're talking about the Mexican-American border, right, the southern border, usually. And, I mean, is that even possible? I lived in San Diego. I've been to the Texas-Mexico border. It's a long ways. I mean, how do you secure such a long stretch of territory?
Well, you know, that's a very good question. And the other question is even if we can, is it worth it financially? I mean, probably. I think the best way to enforce border security is to make sure that there's a reasonable means for people to come in and go out. I mean, part of the problem too is while there's been this big demand for years for jobs for unskilled workers primarily, the United States code only allows for approximately 4,000 green cards for the entire country in the unskilled category. So when you have 4,000 visas that are available and you may have a demand for 4 million, let's say, mm-hmm. well, it's pretty obvious that that's going to get ignored and people are going to come in. So maybe one of the best ways to do it is to implement, you know, a temporary guest worker program or something more permanent that would allow people who have legitimate jobs here in the country, maybe have family members here in the country that we want to reunify them with, to allow them a more rational and reasonable way to immigrate. Like right now, for example, if I'm a permanent resident from Mexico, let's say I have a green card, and I want to bring my wife and my children here, you know, I could be looking at potentially an 8 or 9 year wait to get them here. Now, how realistic is that? And how fair is that? Is that the country that we want to be? We want to be splitting families up and keeping them apart? I don't think that's good policy.
And so in a lot of proponents of sort of more restrictionist policies have said, you know, that's unfair to those immigrants that are going through the process with visas. But and a lot you hear often get in line, you know, sort of there's a line, get in. But that line could be 20 years long for some people.
Right. I mean, I think if a U.S. citizen from the Philippines, you know, but had become a U.S. citizen, wanted to apply for their brother or sister to come from the Philippines, which is permitted under the laws, we could be looking at least a 20-year wait right now.
I could see people saying that's not a line anymore.
Right. Well, and the difference is when you live in the Philippines, you can't just walk across the border.
Right.
You know, there's certain problems that are created by this long, it's called the priority system. And I'm not saying that we should just throw our borders open and let anybody that wants to be here. That's not the solution either. But to go back to the thing about, you know, can we create a border security? Yeah, but I think it has to employ a component also of finding ways that people can legally get here. Because if they can legally get here, we can monitor them, we can track them, we can, know who's here and let in the people that we want to let in and keep everybody else out. So that's, I think, the goal.
And I did want to raise our sort of what we have going on locally here. You know, Metro Police, they participate in a program called 287G, which is a federal local partnership. They train local law enforcement in certain areas. And the program here just pertains to the county jail. So people who are booked into the county jail and express that they were not born here have that certain law enforcement officers are trained to then check databases to see if they have a legal immigrant residency status here. And other states have task forces. For example, they're trained to do immigration checks out in the field or in public. And so I want you mentioned before that you've you paid attention when that program was being implemented. I believe it started in 2008 with Metro Police, that immigration attorneys, the ACLU locally, were just sort of paying attention to see if any reports came out of racial profiling in that instance here locally. And did you find anything? Did any cases actually come out of that?
Well, yeah. I mean, initially, that was the fear, that there would be this big... Because, again, how else can you try to ascertain the status of somebody and go approach somebody to try to obtain their status without using some of these impermissible means, like, you know, skin color, race, language, whatever? So, yeah, we were afraid that that was going to happen. And we did hear some instances reported to us of these kinds of things. But when we would go to check them out, they never really materialized. So in our talks with Sheriff Gillespie's office, and I have to say, I mean, we have to give credit where credit's due. He's not Sheriff Arpaio. He's nothing like that. And I think the initial skepticism and reserve that we had as the immigration lawyer community, it just kind of went away after time. I haven't heard any stories of racial profiling or anything coming out of the Metro for probably at least 2 years. Mm-hmm.
And, of course, Sheriff Arpaio is Joe Arpaio of Maricopa County in Arizona. He's controversial and being investigated, right,
yes,
by federal authorities
yeah,
right now. And Sheriff Gillespie, I mean, he's always made himself available for town halls, correct, with the community in terms of explaining the policies here with Metro Police, and has certainly been more, available and communicative than Sheriff Arpaio, I think we could say.
Yeah.
And now a lot of people have framed this issue in terms of the federal government has not enforced these laws. And you sort of talked about this earlier, but we're really a part of the crux of the issue when we talked about Arizona and when people say they're just trying to enforce federal laws. They actually criminalized what was a civil offense, right? When we talk
Correct.
About all these, when people are here without a legal residency status, that's a civil violation.
Right, right. That's an important point you brought up. Under current federal law, being in the United States without documents is not a crime per se. Immigration, a violation of not being here without papers, is a civil action. And so when a deportation proceeding, when someone gets referred to an immigration judge for a deportation proceeding, that's a civil proceeding. It's not criminal. And when Arizona sought to criminalize this, you know, that's the crux of the Supreme Court decision. They said, no, you can't. You don't have the right to criminalize something that's not a federal crime. So they went far beyond. I mean, a lot of people have said, well, the Arizona law just seeks to, you know, mirror what the federal law is. No, it doesn't. It goes way beyond what the federal law does. And that's where their mistake was.
And then in enforcing, I think one issue that opponents of the law in Arizona said was problematic is that immigration status can be very complicated. As you said, you know, there's judges who are trained to determine these things, which can take months
right.
or years of hearings, and someone could be here with sort of, their status might be in flux. Maybe they're eligible for asylum or something like that. And can local law enforcement be trained sufficiently to make those sort of determinations?
Well, I really don't see how. I mean, honestly, we have immigration judges that are experienced, seasoned, lawyers with years of background and training, and at the end of the day, it's sometimes very difficult to ascertain. An easy example would be, you know, there's a concept in immigration law called derivative citizenship. And so, like, let's say the U.S. citizen born in the United States moves to Mexico and has a child. That child, under certain circumstances, could be a U.S. citizen. But it's those certain circumstances, you know, the devil's in the details. And like, did the parent, U.S. citizen parent, have enough years in the of physical presence in the United States to confer that? I mean, there's rules and complex laws on this. Immigration is one of the most complex areas of law that there is, because every rule has an exception, every exception has another exception, and so on, and it can become just so confusing and so difficult. So I don't really see how a traffic officer can pull somebody over in the space of 15 seconds or something, make some determination on whether someone's illegal or not. That's just ridiculous.
And certainly adding to the confusion for the short term is President Obama passed his executive order, or not passed, but issued his executive order applying to younger unauthorized immigrants who have come to the U.S. before they were 16 and are younger than 30 currently. They also must have no major criminal offenses, have been in the country for at least 5 continuous years, and must graduate from a U.S. high school or have earned a GED or served in the military. And they are then eligible for a 2-year work permit.
Right. And a term called deferred action.
Deferred action. So in terms of deferring deportation.
Right. That just means they're protected from being deported for 2 years. It's not legal status. They can't then change that to, like, let's say, apply for a student visa from that. I mean, it's very, very limited. I believe it's a step in the right direction. I think, you know, for many years, it's been bad policy in this country that we put a lot of resources into educating these young people, and talented young people at that. You know, the ones that I've seen have been very, very impressive and are people that I personally would want to have in my country. But, you know, we educate these young people, we put resources into them, and then tell them to leave? That makes no sense to me.
Right. I mean, we obviously, yeah, they go through colleges and in our high schools, and so that's a lot of tax dollars that we've already spent educating this young population. Right,
right. Right.
And then also I have seen in specifically some of the Spanish language publications in the area, attorneys advertising for consultations. Some might say free consultations, but sort of pertaining to this order, this deferred action, saying, hey, if you qualify, if you're under 30, came here before you were 16, that, you know, you may qualify for this permit. And I mean, is that something that those young people should be going to see an attorney right now about?
Well, that's a very good question. I think it depends on, who that attorney is. I mean, if it's somebody who has a background in immigration law and is going to give good, thorough, ethical advice, then they probably do need to consult with an attorney. I mean, look, this is a big deal for them, and it's going to mean that they're going to, you know, for the first time probably in their lives, they're going to be able to have an employment authorization and get a driver's license and be able to do these things and not have to worry if today's going to be the day that they get that knock on the door and it's an immigration officer. But having said that, you know, every time something like this comes up, some benefit comes up, you just see, you know, a lot of scams, a lot of people coming up and advertising, you know, that hey, if you come and use my, and it's not just lawyers, it's also these notarios. In our community in Nevada, there are these offices called notarios, mm-hmm. which apparently in Mexico, that has one meaning, that the person would be a lawyer and skilled in being able to represent them. Here, it's just a notario is just somebody who has the ability under the law to witness a signature and attest to that person is who they say they are. That's nothing. That doesn't give them any legal knowledge or benefits to a consumer. But we see, especially in the Spanish-speaking communities, a lot of this going on where they'll come in and they'll charge an exorbitant fee. They'll distort or outright make up provisions because clearly on this deferred action thing, there's been no details forthcoming from the administration other than what we knew last Friday. That there is this 2-year deferred action and the qualifications are, like you say, between the ages of 15 and 30. And by the way, it's 31 is the cutoff. Okay. A lot of people think it's 30, but for some reason it's 31. So if you're 30 years old and 364 days on the 15th of June of 2012, you're good.
Okay.
One day after that and you're a problem. But so, yeah, we're seeing that there's some problems, and I would, I guess, just say anybody out there who's considering whether or not they are possibly going to apply for this, that you seek out good, competent legal representation. Don't go with somebody who's advertising and giving away, you know, freebies or telling you, I can make you first in line. They can't. There's no form yet. We don't even know what this is going to look like. So probably for now, leave your money in your pocket and do your homework. And if you want to go consult with reputable attorneys, that's probably not a bad idea.
And now, I think, as you said, this is a deferred action. So therefore, everybody sees this. Even when the president introduced this, he was saying this is just a stopgap, you know, that we still need reform and that there's just been so much gridlock, you could say,
right.
in at the federal level in terms of actually addressing the issue. And you've even expressed to me some frustration over this. I guess you know that immigration is a political football. You're so close to, obviously, you're on the ground dealing with people who have to cope with, you know, the convoluted immigration system and all the laws. As you said, it's complicated. And It sounded like you would just like to see everybody come together and work for, you know, a common goal.
Well, yeah, here's a novel thought. Let's have the Senate and the Congress, you know, get in a room, lock the door, and tell them you can't leave until you've come up with some solution to this. Because it's when I can't really blame one party or another. I mean, it's true that for the first 2 years of this administration, they had 60 votes in the Senate, and they had a majority in the House, and they were unable to do anything with this. They had a last administration, President Bush was in favor of comprehensive immigration reform, but, you know, his party controlled the Senate and the House, and they were against it, so it didn't happen either. And, you know, Obama makes this announcement a couple weeks ago, and everybody's saying, oh, well, it's just political. Yeah, it probably is. I mean, we're not naive here. And at the same time, 2 years ago, when in 2010 in December, when the DREAM Act came up for a vote in the Senate, well, the Republicans voted against it. Many of the people, like Senator Orrin Hatch, who wrote the bill and were original sponsors, voted against it. Was that political? Yeah. So, I mean, both sides are guilty of politicizing immigration and using it perhaps for their own benefit with their political, respective political bases. But I have to say this, that demographically, if the Republicans can't come up with some sort of reasonable position on immigration, the numbers of the growing Latino voters in this country, they're not going to win another presidential election till the end of time, because the numbers are against them. They're not working for them. So I think they're not foolish. I think they see that. I think, you know, we're seeing Governor Romney and other people in the Republican Party like Rubio and Jeb Bush coming up with more reasonable positions on immigration, more centrist positions on immigration, and that's the correct approach.
And some, you know, some would argue that that all we need to do is enforce current law. But do you agree with that, or do you think we need to really address comprehensive immigration reform?
Well, again, if they enforce the employer sanction laws, and they would shut down a lot of businesses, because I believe, and I think, you know, that there are majority of jobs that are being taken by the so-called undocumented workers. Are jobs that U.S. workers probably are unwilling to take. You know, who wants to go pick strawberries and in the sun and you know, work with this manual labor or stuff? But to solve the problem, you know, you're going to have a combination of not just enforcing the employer sanction laws, but you have to make an ability for an employer to be able to get the people in that they need. And we're in the middle of a recession now, you know, unemployment's high, and so, yeah, I understand that now maybe not be the time to look at a program like that. But back in the day when our employment was very low, and I would get employers in my office saying, hey, I need these workers, I need them in here, I have a job, we're building this hotel, and I need floors, I need people to lay carpet, I need all these people, and I can't get them here. And understand, too, that in a work-related visa, an employer first has to make a showing of an inability to hire somebody domestically. And that's a nightmare in and of itself. So this is not just an employer wanting to say, oh, well, I'll hire somebody cheaper, because they have to still show that they're paying the prevailing wage. And if they lie about that, then the fines are substantial.
So it certainly sounds like something the federal government will have to settle their differences and address. Well, thank you for joining us. Our guest today has been Peter Ashman, immigration attorney for 27 years in Las Vegas and spokesman for the Las Vegas chapter of the American Immigration Lawyers Association. You've been listening to Neon Eden on 91.5 KUNV.
Thank you.